You're listening to the Autism Weekly Podcast. Each week, we share community voices and bring light to stories that increase awareness, acceptance, equity, access, and inclusion. If you haven't already, subscribe to join the Autism Weekly family. I'm your host, Jeff Skibitsky. This week, we're joined by Dr. Han Ren, a licensed clinical and school psychologist, consultant, and speaker, deeply committed to liberation and anti-oppressive work. Through widely viewed social media content, Dr. Ren makes mental health accessible, focusing on collective healing in marginalized communities like Asian Americans and children of immigrants. Featured on TEDx, Headspace, BuzzFeed, and Huffington Post, Dr. Ren advocates for culturally affirming care. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Han Ren.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Well, it's my pleasure. And this is actually a topic I love talking about just because I don't know that we have given it enough of a space within the therapeutic community. And then also just as far as any sort of advocacy work and legislative work. But maybe you can give us a little bit of background of where your interest came in empowering diverse communities, but also within the neurodivergent community itself.
Yeah, I actually got my start in the field of psychology by doing ABA. I was an at-home behavior therapist in my undergrad years, and I worked with a family for many years. And then from there expanded to more hospital clinics. And after I graduated, I was a special educator for several years and, you know, applied some of these more behavioral philosophies to the classroom and interventions there. And then I realized that there's only so much you can do in the classroom. The impact can be very deep and meaningful for the students who you're working with, but beyond your classroom, there's not as much impact. And I also realized that, you know, in these low-income Title I schools, there's so much more that goes into wellness and education and the ability to access education than, you know, instructional methods or content. The mental health is such a huge element of that. And that inspired me to go back to grad school and get my doctorate in child clinical and school psychology. And from there, it was, you know, every layer of the onion, you realize, oh my gosh, there's so much more. And so once I started practicing, I expanded beyond just focusing on children and working more with adults and people across the lifespan and realizing there has to be so much more of a systems focus when it comes to applying, you know, cultural affirming care and liberation oriented and neurodivergent affirming care, just, you know, challenging systems of oppression everywhere that it shows up, which really truly is everywhere.
Well, before we get into actually, you know, defining and elaborating on each of those components of the liberation oriented, anti-oppressive, culturally informed mental health, before we go there, I do want to, I guess, get a better description of what it felt like when you initially entered the field, because you said that you started out in the ABA space, and ABA, as far as the research, as far as the first application, it was very defined around almost a homogenous culture.
Absolutely.
Did some of that, I mean, what resonated there, and what do you think was missing at that time that maybe in the classroom that maybe we're teaching to a very specific cultural paradigm? Or, I mean, I don't want to flavor the response, but I mean, what did you see at that point of your career that kind of pushed you to say, you know, we should rethink some of this?
Yeah, I mean, I started ABA like, you know, low vas table time, late 90s, early 2000s. So it was really in the heyday of like, wow, this is evidence-based. These are families are seeing so much progress with their children. They are, what do they call them? Indistinguishable by the time they reach kindergarten. And that was the goal, was, you know, to make children indistinguishable, whether they actually felt that way on the inside or not. And so I really felt that, you know, despite the gains that I could see the families having and the children really being able to like operate within the, you know, world that they lived in, they were still really struggling with a lot of different elements of, you know, freedom of being able to express themselves. I felt really guilty doing some of the around stimming and sensory seeking. And I think it was several years into this when I got really deep into the hospital work where, you know, children are coming in with significant high support needs. And I was talking to a BCBA there, and she was a mom of a young child. And she said that her daughter was learning to swim and would only go swimming with her goggles. And she didn't want her daughter to become dependent on the goggles. So she just threw her child into the water without the goggles. And that felt so horrifying to me. And I wasn't a parent, and, you know, I kind of smiled and nodded, but it really felt reductionistic. Like, yes, you want to be aware of like what behavioral supports you're putting in when you're teaching a new behavior. And there's so much more that goes into the human experience beyond what is observable and, you know, the antecedent behavior consequence paradigm. And so that's when I really started getting some doubts about it. And then when I entered the classroom and I had a lot more autonomy to design my own programs, I realized there was so much that, you know, was not going to be effective if it was just happening in this small bubble without the contextual information of the lives that my students were living outside of the classroom.
Yeah, I think I experienced a similar journey to what you have experienced as well, is that I went through the path over the last 25 years of starting off with the same sort of low VAS, very specific methodology, which it has its place. But it, what I really appreciated is recently is that there's been a huge movement to really being able to evaluate culturally sensitive, neurodiversity affirming, and ascent-based care, which I think all wraps into some of the concepts that hopefully we'll discuss, because not only is this ABA, but this is all therapy that should be looking at a lot of context here. So what does, and we have a broad audience here who probably this terminology is like, oh, come on, let's break this down. But what does liberation-oriented, anti-oppressive, and culturally informed mental health, what does that mean for a family? And what does it mean in general?
Well, the historical roots of liberation psychology came from Latin America in the 80s, you know, from the work of Frantz Fanon and Ignacio Martin Barro. It was psychology made for the oppressed by the oppressed, with all the civil war stuff going on in Latin in the 80s. There was a need for kind of an uprising where we really are taking into account the impacts of oppression, power differentials, and systems in the mental health and individual well-being of people. And so that's really the roots of it. And then, you know, throughout the past 30 years, it has spread more globally. And as we have seen sort of the political landscape become more polarized and, you know, worldwide movements towards high control, fascism types of beliefs, liberation psychology has become even more important as a way to give voice to the oppressed and recognizing that, you know, it's not one size fits all. And a lot of the history of psychology and mental health care as a whole is based in oppressive, Eurocentric, individualistic paradigms. And so liberation psychology really calls that into question and asks us to examine the power differentials and take kind of a structural analysis approach to who is this made for? How is it working? Who is this serving? Why are we doing this? And this really shifts from the biopsychosocial medical model of psychopathology where, you know, is housed within the individual and decontextualized. It can be very beneficial for some people who tend to experience life in a more dominant characteristics, falling within dominant frameworks. But for those of us who have been marginalized or minoritized, a lot of this doesn't work or apply when you strip it of culture and context.
So when we're talking about neurodivergent families or those who identify as autistic or neurodivergent themselves as individuals, you had mentioned some of those things earlier as far as, you know, you need to look like us, you need to behave or think like us in order for acceptance. Is that the same sort of philosophy of, you know, therapy might need to look at what's empowering for that individual versus how to make that individual fit a norm or fit a box?
Yes, absolutely. And so that's what antidepressive care is. It's, you know, examining the spectrum of power to oppression for every single domain, whether we're talking about race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, relationship orientation, neurodivergence, you know, neuronormativity is absolutely a thing, saying that neurotypical folks are, you know, the normal, the sets the tone for how society should operate. But we know that diversity is what makes the world go around in all its forms, and being able to embrace and amplify and empower people whose brains work differently to still find, you know, their own place in the world without having to conform and contort so specifically to fit this norm.
So when you're talking about this philosophy, I almost immediately question why this isn't embedded into all treatment, into all therapies. And you do a variety of therapies yourself, if I'm correct. So what does this look like? If a clinician is saying, you know, this needs to be a core part of how I practice, how would that change from what would be a traditional therapy model?
Yeah, it's really taken a lot of background information, working more collaboratively with your clients or, you know, therapy seekers. It's working with the open-mindedness of, like, I don't know everything. This doesn't have to be this hierarchical relationship. You are the expert on your own life. I'm the expert on some things when it comes to the brain and learning and mental health, but there's always room to grow. It's tuning to what we don't know and being curious about it rather than coming in with, like, assuredness or, you know, an expert model of what we do know. I think a lot of times the interventions that are focused, you know, cognitions and behaviors and what is going to help a person on an individual basis. And it doesn't take into account, well, this person comes from a collectivist background and they can't just tell their parents, oh, I'm going to set boundaries with you and not see you this weekend. That's going to really cause a lot of trouble for them longer term and in the homeostasis of their community. It's taking into awareness that not everything, you know, that we define as, like, self-care is going to be accessible for people who don't have the financial means. It's taking into account that a person may be very hypervigilant around police or certain members of authority, and it's not just in their head. It's something that has been validated and, you know, in their bones and their lineage for generations. And of course, they're going to feel that degree of vigilance. And so it really takes context, history, generations, and trauma into account a lot more than traditional Eurocentric models do.
Yeah, and it almost seems like the way that I am hearing what you're saying is that, you know, as a field within the therapeutic model, we've always said, hey, we need to look at the ecology of family, but we've never really focused on the culture itself, and that you've defined some urban cultures, some ethnic cultures. I mean, there's so much out there that probably constitutes who this individual is and who their unit or who their community is, and that's what you're treating, is to empower them to collaborate and contribute back to their community. So when we're doing this, and is there a therapeutic model where you're saying, hey, you know what, this doesn't fit? Like, if I'm doing ABA and you've done that historically, is that why wouldn't this be a core piece to the evaluation before creating some treatment plan that you do with the individual, with the family, to really understand how it impacts that part of themselves, that identity?
Yeah, I mean, it really should be baked into everything, but it requires a lot of finagling around, you know, creative ways to implement interventions. It's not as cookie cutter. It's, you know, more work and more labor in some ways. And there's also a lot about our systems that we actually can't change. And so, you know, that can be really frustrating and disheartening for a lot of folks when we realize, gosh, there's so many layers of oppression at every single level, and it's rooted in supremacy culture and, you know, whiteness and patriarchy and capitalism and all of these major systems that the world operates under. And at the root of it, it's rooted in colonization. And, you know, these are not things that we can address nearly as readily as, okay, let's reward this behavior, or oops, had an intrusive thought, snap a rubber band, you know. So it's a lot more labor intensive, and it's a lot deeper heart work. And not every, you know, consumer is going to be in a place to be able to access that either, nor does, you know, everybody want to do that. Some people just want symptom relief. And so it really depends on who you're working with and what their specific goals are. But I think when you peel away the layers of the onion, you can't ignore that these major systemic forces are at the roots of some of the world's greatest suffering.
When you're doing child-based work, and when we're trying to bring in the family unit, I would imagine some of that historic oppression that you're describing has already affected the family, and the fact that they're saying, you know, this is what I've told I need to do for my child, this is what I've told my child needs to look like to fit in. So is there a part to this where we need to be focusing on the family and helping them to understand what it is that they want versus what they're told to want prior to even the treatment process? Or is that something that's just, you know, it lives the life of treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something you want to get clear on prior to the treatment process, but of course, iterate and evolve throughout treatment. You know, an example of this is, you know, in the past decade or so, we've seen a lot of pushback against ABA, just from people who have experienced it in their childhoods, and it has been deemed abusive, and rightfully so for a lot of these people's lived experiences. But it's kind of like a pendulum. Then you swing to this other extreme where everyone's like staunchly anti-ABA, and then they're accessing these different types of care and intervention. However, are these things covered by insurance? Are these treatments accessible to people who aren't as well-versed? A lot of times when people are surviving in, you know, trying to support special needs children, they are going to veer towards whatever is accessible to them. And after years of advocacy, ABA is the most accessible insurance covered intervention at this point. And maybe, you know, in more privileged families, you don't have to have your child get in line in any meaningful way because you have the privilege of, you know, whiteness and money and security to keep your child from being harmed when they are having an autistic meltdown. But in some families, there is some need to kind of appear more neurotypical as a matter of safety, as a matter of not having, you know, police called, and, you know, these tragic stories that we hear constantly about how our law enforcement still doesn't know how to interact with people having mental health crises. So, you know, you have to consider all of these different ecosystems all at the same time, and the ways that they interact and are layered on top of each other, which makes it complicated, because it depends. The answer is it depends. There's no simple way to just, you know, one size fits all with this.
Yeah, and I think that we both, as we've shared earlier, have lived an experience where we've seen some evolution of the science of the treatment of the therapy over time. And I think that's the fact that, you know, the more that you're open-minded, the more that you're able to take in different perspectives, is that you're making things better as time goes on. So you don't have to live in the polarized world. As long as you can communicate, ideally, you can start to repair some of those areas that might need some reparation. And I think that when we're talking about cultural sensitivity, when we're talking about, because you mentioned there's marginalized communities out there, mm-hmm. What are some of the areas right now within mental health treatment that you'd say we have extreme either prejudice or we're lacking information in the way that we're treating people because we have not really understood their culture to this point? And it's causing some deleterious effect.
I mean, I think anytime we have, you know, cross-cultural pairings between therapist and client, it's a time to be extra aware and diligent about your cultural humility and, you know, being as affirming as possible without putting the labor on your client to educate you. We've seen a lot of poor impacts by having, you know, like white therapists with a lot of power and access and, you know, dominant ideology working with clients of color who may not have access to those resources and may feel completely misunderstood by, you know, these like mainstream interventions about boundary setting or, you know, clear and direct communication, which just doesn't apply as much in some collectivist cultures. And then we're also looking at, you know, how the world is very heteronormative, cisnormative, mononormative. There's not a lot of integration to the diversity and fluidity when it comes to gender, sexuality, or relationships. And people, when they apply those frameworks in their interventions and they assume certain elements about a person's well-being based on these assumptions, they can really go astray and you know, pathologize things that don't necessarily need to be pathologized. And same with, you know, parenting strategies and tactics. There's such a diversity in that too. And I really see like all of this as a pendulum. We're trying to figure out like just where we are in the swing of things. And like, we're always kind of course correcting, and sometimes that leads to overcorrection. But being able to be self-aware, self-reflective, mindful, and flexible about how we approach this based on the information that we're getting with from the people that we're working with and their specific context is, I think, you know, the most valuable skill set.
If you were to, I guess, coach me on this aspect right now, is that when I walk into a situation where I know that I'm not going to be fully versed in the culture, My first inclination is that it's okay that I might have some ignorance here, as long as I have humility to ask the questions, get informed, and become a part of that partnership so that I can build trust, so they can help guide me, and together we can come up with the right options, decisions, and move forward. You had mentioned that we can't put the reliance on the family educating us. So where's the balance on that? Because I'd immediately say, you know, I don't know enough about your culture. I need to learn more. Can you please help me to be able to understand, or at least course correct me during the treatment, of where there might be some misguidance on my part? Where is that balance?
Yeah, I think that's going to be an individual case by case basis. But you want to, you know, invite the you want to be open for feedback and invite the collaboration, you know, every step of the way, that, you know, maybe you say something deliberately wrong and see if they correct you. And if they don't correct you, like, hey, how come you didn't correct me? Let's talk about that. Can we talk about ways that we can build the trust and safety so that you can be more honest and open with me? And then depending on whatever the culture or, you know, backgrounds and context of this person's lived experiences, doing your own research, reading books by people who share that background, or talking to, you know, cultural brokers and consultants around, you know, things to keep in mind when working with people of a certain background. And then, you know, depending on the family or the client's degree of assimilation or acculturation to dominant culture, they might say like, you know what, this isn't as big of a salient element to my identity, and like, we can operate, you know, from a more mainstream perspective. Or they might say, this is a huge element of my identity, and there's nothing that you can learn or do, and there's nothing that I can teach you that's really going to help me get that sense of safety. And so I need to go find someone who shares more similar characteristics with me from a lived perspective. And that's okay too. We're not for everyone, and not every clinician and client pairing is going to be the best fit.
Yeah, and fit is extremely important. One of the challenges that we run into in the mental health field in general, and in psychology and in behavioral analytic work especially, is that when you look at who the psychologists are, when you look at who the behavior analysts are, there isn't a proportion that's going to match the client base. And So it puts the onus on the clinician to say, I need to start working on some of these things. Is where's the start for that? I mean, should it be more in the education program from day one when you enter into a master's program, doctorate program, that this should be embedded in the thought process? Or is it something absolutely. That we seek on our own?
I mean, both, right? Like a lot of us who, you know, were educated 10, 20 years ago, this was not baked into our curriculum. This was an afterthought. This was one class, if that. And so, you know, if we are already licensed and well established in our careers, it is on us to seek out additional guidance and training on ways to be anti-racist, anti-oppressive, and more culturally humble. In terms of graduate programs, there's so much gatekeeping just from the jump when it comes to the types of students they admit and what they require from, you know, their applicant pool. And that's something that these systems need to address and check themselves on. Why are we only admitting people who are coming from a certain demographic? And it really can't be the answers like, oh, they are the best, right? Like that's, you know, that's a very limited lens through which to look at what it constitutes the best. And when it comes to cultural fit, like that is going to lead to the best care for a lot of these families. So just starting from the recruitment process, we as a field need to be more conscious of, you know, our gatekeeping.
Absolutely. And I would also, I guess, put out there is that a lot of the research right now is not including this in there, is that we've been lucky enough within my organization to be involved with community informed practice research and neurodiversity affirming care research. But it's still in its nascence as far as within the field of behavioral health. And one of the things I'd say is that if we could get more people focused on this and more research, I think that it becomes more of an accepted and an immersive practice into what everybody's implementing in the field. Where do you envision that these approaches kind of moving as time goes on? Is it something that it's going to still take a lot of time for the practitioner field to realize, A, how to do it, B, that they should be doing it, and C, when and where their competencies are missing? Like, where should we go?
I think this is such a hard question to answer because, you know, obviously I'm very passionate about it and I have very strong beliefs on where it should go. And, you know, our mental health field is a reflection of our cultural zeitgeist. And if you look at the polarization of our culture and our politics and, you know, the elimination of diversity, equity, inclusion programs from entire states and just the more oppressive, conservative leanings of, you know, policymaking, you know, the anti-queer, anti-trans, anti-women's health type of legislation that we are seeing across the country, like, it makes this goal feel so much further away than it even did 5 years ago. And so, you know, we have to be able to advocate for policy shifts from a very broad perspective, if we really hope that this will take root on, you know, kind of the micro niche scale that we're looking at when it comes to behavioral health. I certainly believe that there is a lot we can still do when it comes to just education within our own communities and our own practices and systems. But it is something that we are running into a lot of pushback from on a more broad cultural level.
I mean, it feels to me as if in the practice of psychology or mental health is that this is a logical movement. It makes a lot of sense that this should be applied. So the emotions of politics really just, it doesn't quite match up to me of like, no. Why that's causing this problem, but it is. And I mean, it means that time is going to have to be put into it. What resources would you be guiding parents or clinicians to right now to make sure on these individual cases that they understand or that they have a voice through the process to start to be able to self-advocate in some of these situations? Are there specific resources that we should all be aware of?
You know, I think there's a lot of great, you know, content creators now on social media who come from a variety of backgrounds. There's a lot of great justice-oriented, liberatory, you know, clinicians who are speaking about, this is what you should be aware of when you're looking for a therapist, or these are the questions you should be asking. This is how therapy should be in order to be more systems informed and liberation oriented. When it comes to, there's definitely books, right? There's books that are written about, decolonizing therapy, decolonizing the body, lots of liberation oriented books. I'm not super aware about, autism in general. I know that Sunny Jane Wise, the lived experience counselor, which, they are based in Australia, I believe they have the neurodiversity affirming DBT book, and I think are working on other projects around more neurodivergence affirming care. I think the more that we can just hodgepodge our own resources and education around this, the better we can inform our own communities. But in terms of just definitive sources, I'm not super aware of sources that are accessible for families that aren't just really academic or theory based.
Well, I mean, I think that just the fact that you're out there and that you're having people talk about this, think about this, listen to some of the perspectives that are out there, is that hopefully more of these resources will start to come about, and that there be more education on how to be able to implement this and how to make this a priority in practice. But Dr. Wren, I really appreciate you coming on today and being able to talk us through some of these complex issues and put an arrow on some of the things that we need to really start to understand and prioritize in the way that we care for our clients.
Yeah, absolutely. Listening to people who have this lived experience is so essential. Some of my my favorite autism educators have been on social media. Nye Functioning Autism, Fidget and Fries, these are all Black moms who are advocating for their children, advocating for themselves, and sharing their lived experience, navigating the medical industrial complex as women of color. So these are the primary sources that we should be taking our cues from, and I hope more of us do.
Well, thank you again, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Autism Weekly. We hope you tune back in next week to learn more about autism in the real world. Autism Weekly is now found on all the major listening apps, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Subscribe to be notified when we post a new podcast. Autism Weekly is produced by ABS Kids. ABS Kids is proud to provide diagnostic assessments and ABA therapy to children with developmental delays like autism spectrum disorder. You can learn more about ABS Kids and the Autism Weekly podcast by visiting abskids.com. Thanks for tuning in. See you again next week.